Welcome, everyone. My name is Helena Kennedy, and I'm the principal here at Mansfield College. And it's my very great pleasure to welcome you to the special occasion of the annual Adam von Trott Lecture. I just wanted to tell any of you who didn't know, and I think there will be few, but Adam von Trott, Zusatz, was a central figure in the conspiracy to kill Hitler. He was put to death in Berlin on the 26th of August, 1944. Adam was born in Potsdam in 1909, and he trained as a lawyer in Germany. He studied here at Oxford. He travelled widely and made many international contacts. He loved his country, but he hated Nazism. And with other opponents of the regime, made plans for post-war Europe. His life was shaped by his experience at Oxford, he always said so, and his vision of European cooperation has resonance for us today. So you're going to ask, why Mansfield College? Well, in 1929, the principal then of Mansfield College invited Adam von Trott to Oxford. He was a young man, 17, and he invited him. He knew the von Trott family, and he invited him to come and study and get a taste of Oxford, and he did, and came and studied theology and politics here at Mansfield. And he wrote about this experience, and he said that it helped him to learn what democracy means. He then returned to Oxford, encouraged by the principal who was still here, and in fact played a role of bringing money out to people who were going through straitened circumstances in Germany. But he returned to Oxford in 1931 and went to Balliol as a Rhodes Scholar, where he studied philosophy, politics and economics, a degree that wasn't available here at that time. The Adam von Trott Memorial Appeal has been launched here at Mansfield College in 2004. And it organises an annual lecture like this one and has been doing for some years, and other events on themes related to the life and ideas of Adam von Trott. And it supports, very importantly, the Adam von Trott Scholarship, which brings a German student here to Oxford to study a master's degree. The annual lecture is given by usually a distinguished scholar, and we have a particularly distinguished scholar tonight. But there are other public events that have been organised, sometimes in London at the German Embassy, more often here in Oxford. And the themes usually relate, if not to the life and times of Adam von Trott, certainly to themes that emanate from that, of being the lone voice of resistance, of speaking out in the way that is hard to do in certain circumstances. The scholarship, as I've said, brings young German students to Oxford for 2 years to study a master's degree, and it has to be in politics or international relations. Those were the subjects close to Adam von Trott's heart. Since 2010, it's been awarded by this college jointly with Oxford University's Department of Politics and International Relations, and it's supported by the Adam von Trott Memorial Appeal Fund. It's a wonderful committee of really committed people who raise funds for this. The scholarship is awarded every second year, and up to now there have been three scholars, Diana Kuster, Bernard Klemm, and David Hagel-Bulling, who's here tonight. I want to make a special mention of the role that's played by the German Foreign Office and by the embassy here in Britain. And I want to thank Suzanne Fram and Charlotte Schwarzer for being with us tonight. And they have been really supportive, as indeed has the ambassador and previous ambassadors, to this project. I want to give them thanks for their financial support, for providing an annual grant for each Adam von Trott scholar. And that's going to continue into the years ahead, we hope. So there's no need to go into that in too much depth, but we really value this link with Germany and the way that it brings a young person of scholarship to Oxford and the relationships that are sustained by doing so. I wanted tonight to remind us all of a special person, Dr. Elaine Kay. She, along with Geoffrey Beck, the Reverend Geoffrey Beck, were given recognition in this very room by the German Embassy for services to Anglo-German cooperation. So too was Kenneth Sears, who with them, they were all founding members of the Adam von Trott Memorial Appeal. Ken died, and indeed Elaine has just died. We particularly want to remember Elaine because it's only been in this last month that she passed away, and she made an enormous contribution to this college, but she particularly pressed for this scholarship to come into existence, and so I want us to remember her tonight. Now, I want to introduce Graham Avery, who's the convener of the Adam von Trott Memorial Appeal, and he's just going to say a few words before I introduce the wonderful speaker we have tonight. So, Graham, have you got a few words to say? Oops!
Thank you very much. I don't need to say much because all of you should have found on your seat this excellent leaflet which explains the activities of our committee. We organise lectures like this and we support the scholarship at this college. So I want to limit myself to three remarks. First, I want to present to you David Hagerbully, who's here tonight, our present scholar. Could you stand up, David? There he is. Please stand up. He's studying here for an MPhil in International Relations. Second, I want to thank those of you here tonight who've already contributed generously to our memorial appeal, and I want to encourage others to do so. Together with the leaflet on your seat, you should have found a donation form, so I encourage you to use it. Thirdly, I just want to thank the principal and the staff of Mansfield, and particularly the development office under the leadership of Helen Jones, for all their help in organising these events. Thank you.
Now to our wonderful speaker tonight, Professor Margaret McMillan. She's well known to this college. We had a wonderful time with her on a previous occasion when she came to talk to us. And in fact, everybody sort of votes it one of the great lectures we've all had on our Sunday's Friday night talks at the Mansfield series. And so we couldn't wait to get her back again. And so it's very nice that she had accepted this invitation to be here with us. She is an incredible scholar, but she's got that skill that not all scholars have, which is that she can write for a much wider audience in a way that's very accessible. And I first came across Margaret before realising that we'd lots of other connections, when she wrote a book called 6 Months That Changed the World, Paris 1919. It was the most fantastic book about the Treaty of Versailles, and it was really, you felt you were in there and involved in it. And it won the Samuel Johnson Prize, and it really was just the most incredible book. And then I was a judge on the Samuel Johnson Prize some years later, and she was shortlisted with her book, Nixon in China, 6 Days That Changed the World. And, you know, it was, I championed the book right to the very edge, I have to tell you, Margaret, because I loved it. And again, it was about taking you into a moment in history, a period in history that was short and defined, but out of which you could see the stuff that went before that took you to this place, and why she's such a remarkable historian in being able to use something to illustrate something much bigger. She's also written on the women of the Raj. She's written about extraordinary Canadians. Her books are wonderful. And her recent book, her most recent book, The War That Ended Peace, again, has been widely celebrated. You'll have heard it read on radio. It was just an extraordinary book, and it was so timely because, of course, it was dealing with the First World War in that anniversary last year. I recommend it to you all. She is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, a senior fellow of Massey College at the University of Toronto. She actually ran one of the colleges at the university there, Trinity College. And she is, I could describe all the many honours she's received from universities and other boards and institutions around the world. She is now, as many of you will know, the head of St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and she is one of the jewels in Oxford's crown. Can I welcome Margaret McMillan?
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. You almost had me believing it myself. But it's a great pleasure to be here again, and it's a great honor to be giving the Adam von Trott annual lecture here. This is in memory of someone who was such a figure and such an extraordinarily brave person, and who is, I think, an example that we all need in what can be very troubled times. When I agreed a year ago to talk on varieties of resistance, I put it in my diary, and then I'm ashamed to say forgot about it for a time, until I met someone who's here tonight, somewhere at the back, who said, oh, I'm looking forward to your lecture on varieties of resistance. And I said, what? But I've been thinking about it a lot, and I've kind of decided that what I want to do is focus on resistance in war. But I would like to make some general points about resistance, because as we all know, there are many varieties. I think there is no clear definition, but there is this point at which someone or a group of people say no. We will not do this, or we will not accept this. They can resist in violent ways, and often do. They can resist in non-violent ways. They can resist by absenting themselves. I would argue that they can resist by telling jokes. In the old Soviet Union, there was something called Radio Yerevan, which was meant to be the Armenian state radio, and it was a source of endless jokes about the system. Even rock music is and was a type of resistance. During the Cold War in Czechoslovakia, there was a group after 1968 who called themselves the Leninists. Not named after Lenin, but John Lennon. And this was, again, the authorities didn't like it. They couldn't quite put their finger on why they didn't like it. But I would argue that it was a type of resistance. I want to look particularly at resistance in war because it seems to me that that is when often the dilemmas become most acute. How much should you go along with either an occupation or with your own government? And this, of course, was the dilemma that Adam von Trott and his colleagues faced in Germany. How much should you resist your own government? How much should you resist your own society? As we look at the people who resisted, and I will look both at groups and individuals, I think we need to be very careful, as we always do in history, not to make judgments. I think there is a tendency, particularly when it comes to moral issues, like resistance, to say, they should have done this, they should have done that. And I think what we always need to remember, and what we always need to try and understand, is the context. Understand what it was that people faced. Understand that resistance at times can be very difficult. Understand that resistance, even of a moderate form, can put in peril not just yourself, but those that you love. And so I think we need to be very careful not to look at the past and make judgments. I think there's been a tremendous burden borne by Jews since 1945, looking back at the Holocaust, and this sense that somehow the Jews helped in their own destruction. And I think that is a burden that no people should have to bear. I think we do have to remember just what it was that those who were designated for destruction were facing. And I think we need to be very careful in not judging. What I want to look at, as I look at resistance in war, is both the resistance itself, but of course the changing nature of war, and the ways in which people were thinking about war, because resistance takes place in very different contexts, and what is classified as resistance has varied from century to century and from place to place. And so I'll be looking quite a bit at changing definitions of wars and the ways in which gradually rules of war began to emerge. And these, of course, affected the definition of resistance, affected the treatment of those who were seen as resisting occupation or resisting tyranny in other ways. In the Renaissance, there was considerable discussion of what was justified in going to war and what was justified in the conduct of war. And very gradually, in the 16th and 17th centuries, ideas began to emerge about what was the nature of war itself, but also what were the limits on war. And this was, of course, a very difficult conversation because it seems almost improbable that you can limit war, that you can have rules of war, that you can make war something that is amenable to war. But gradually, through the work of people like Hugo Grotius, the great jurist, you began to get the emergence of ideas that there should be limits on what can legitimately be done in war and what cannot legitimately be done. And that affected both the treatment of those who lived in zones that were occupied or in zones that soldiers and armies were marching through, but of course also affected those who might decide to take up arms against an occupying force or against a force that was marching through. Initially, the debate was over how to treat civilians, and initially, certainly in the 16th century, there was a general assumption that civilians were simply what we today would call collateral damage. If they were in the way, they died. If it was a way of putting pressure on a city that was being besieged or a town that was being besieged to kill all the surrounding civilians and destroy all the surrounding crops, then that again was something that was legitimate. Plunder was seen as fair game, and I think that partly reflected attitudes at the time towards those who were being plundered. Farmers, peasants, were seen as somehow not quite as human as anyone else, and therefore it was quite legitimate to plunder them. Gradually, however, ideas began to emerge that this was, in fact, something that needed to be brought under control. And I think it's a result partly of Christian ideas, partly older ideas of chivalry and the protection of the weak and the helpfulness, the helpless, and I think partly also a result of a recognition that war was not just hugely costly in terms of the destruction of human beings, but it was actually hugely costly for those armies that were fighting it. That if you destroyed all the civilians, if you destroyed all the livestock, if you destroyed all the crops, then you were going to have trouble surviving yourself. And so I think for a variety of practical and moral and ethical reasons, gradually some sort of agreement began to emerge in Europe about how you treated civilians. And when it was legitimate for civilians to resist, because this was something that went really step by step. By the 18th century, armies were becoming something that were both more separate from society and also more disciplined. Increasingly, the military lived in their own barracks. Increasingly, they had an ethos that was distinct from that of civilian society. And that was both difficult for civilians, the military tended to regard them as somehow a different species, but it also helped to create the idea that civilians had a right to be treated in a different way from the military. And so you gradually got the emergence of civilians as people who had rights of some sort, rights to be treated decently. Now, when did civilians lose those rights? And this again was a subject of great argument. Did civilians lose their rights to be treated decently if they picked up guns and tried to shoot the invading or the occupying forces? Did they become people who had therefore put themselves outside the rules? Could they therefore be killed? Could reprisal therefore be taken against them? And so you get a tension, which I think has been really in our thinking about resistance ever since in war. When is it all right to take up arms against invaders? When is it all right for those invaders to act with severity, carrying out dreadful reprisals? These questions, which were there in the 18th century, I think became even more acute in the 19th and 20th centuries. And I think they become acute partly because the scale of war is getting so much bigger, and partly again because the nature of war is changing. The ways in which war changes clearly are going to affect the ways in which we think about what is just in war and what is just in resisting war and occupation. The changes I think we're all familiar with, these are social, economic, industrial, scientific changes. European society becomes much more integrated. Nation states begin to emerge, which begin to incorporate much larger numbers of their population. Cities begin to grow, communications begin to make people aware that they are part of larger organizations called nations. There's also, I think, a very important change in the relationship between people and the states in which they live. Partly as a result of the American Revolution, and I think partly as a result of the French Revolution, people begin to move and begin to think of themselves in a different way. They begin to move from being subjects to citizens. Whereas before the American Revolution or the French Revolution, it was, I think, far more usual for people to think of themselves as subjects of a particular ruler. Or if they thought of themselves at all as being part of a unit, it was probably a much smaller unit than a nation. Although there is some evidence in the 18th century that people are beginning to think of themselves as nations. If you are a citizen, you not only have a different relationship to your ruler, but you also have an obligation to the polity in which you find yourself. And I think this comes out very, very clearly in the French Revolution, when the revolutionary French government of the early 1790s not only makes the subjects of France citizens, but then calls upon them to defend the revolution and to defend France. And so in 1792, you get, as the enemies of the French Revolution begin to gather on France's borders, you get the notion that the patrie, the country, the homeland, is in danger, and you get the first appearance of irregular forces. French citizens, as they now are, beginning to form themselves into armed bands, armed with whatever they can find, beginning to create themselves into larger and larger units in order to defend both the revolution and the territory of France. And this is encouraged by the revolutionary French government. In August 1793, as the enemies of France now are moving onto French soil, they announce something called the Levée en masse. And this becomes a very important concept in the 19th and 20th century, the idea that citizens of a country can rise up together. They don't have to be organized into formal armies. They don't have to go and enlist. They can simply rise up and be prepared to withstand those who are occupying. Let me just read part of the proclamation that announced the Lede en masse. From this moment until the enemy is driven from the territory of the Republic, all the French people are permanently requisitioned for the armies. The young men will go to the front. Married men will forge arms and carry supplies. Women will make tents and clothing. Children will divide old linen into bandages. Old men will be carried into the squares to rouse the courage of the soldiers, to teach hatred of kings and the unity of the Republic. And so we get the appearance of something called the Nation in Arms. It was, I think, a very important step forward. You could see it already beginning to happen in the earlier period, but now I think you get an enunciation of a new sort of principle. I think interestingly also that you get women now included. Women increasingly are now going to be part of the war effort, and increasingly in time are going to be part of resistance. What in fact happened was that this idea that the nation had a legitimate right, and people in that nation had a legitimate right to rise up and resist invaders, to resist occupation, was something the French armies unwittingly helped to spread through the rest of Europe. The French revolutionary armies may have gone out of France, and they became, of course, increasingly successful as the 1790s wore on. They may have gone out of France thinking that they were spreading equality, liberty, and fraternity, but what they were also spreading into the countries in which they came was the idea that you should resist the invaders. The very ideas of citizenship and nationalism, which had bound the French together, now began to affect those who they were conquering. And so you saw, in Spain, the birth of guerrilla warfare, and that's where, of course, the name comes from, where governments used the terms such as national state of emergency, and called on all the people of Spain to organize themselves to resist the French. And you had something very similar happening in Prussia. You had something very similar happening in Russia. And so you begin to get this tension really now playing out between organized armies, organized forces, and the organization of people, the spontaneous organization of people to defend themselves. And this, of course, was difficult for armies to deal with. It was one thing for them to fight another army, where the rules had by now been fairly established. What did they do with those citizens who were rising up to resist them? And there was a pattern that was to develop in the 19th and 20th centuries of armies really not quite knowing what to do. Armies irritated by this resistance, finding it annoying, finding that often it was costly to try and deal with, and wishing that it would go away and finding that it wouldn't. I mean, there were those who argued that all acts by those who were occupied against the military forces occupying them are illegal, and therefore anyone carrying out acts of resistance is, as the French described them in Spain, bandits and brigands, and who deserve absolutely no consideration. Savage reprisals are perfectly all right, because these people, by resisting, by attacking invading French forces, for example, have forfeited all the rights to be treated as regular soldiers. This was something that was, as I say, going to continue on into the 20th century. We also see, as war gets more complicated, of course, it's on a much larger scale, and increasingly, as the 19th century wears on, we see wars in which this tension plays itself out in very bloody ways. And I'd like to just mention two. First of all, the American Civil War, which, of course, has the particular added complication and horror of being a civil war, so that it is a war fought among people who are quite literally part of the same family. In the American Civil War, both sides used savage reprisal against the other side. They saw it as a perfectly legitimate target of war. Of course, Sherman's famous march to the sea in 1864, he said, "We are not fighting hostile armies, but a hostile people, and must make old and young, rich and poor, feel the hard hand of war, as well as their organized armies." And so the distinction which had so carefully been built up in the 17th and 18th centuries between civilians and soldiers now begins to break down again, partly as a result of changes in society, partly as a result of the greater involvement of people in their own society, but partly also as a result of the increasingly demanding nature of modern war. In the old days, and this is something of a simplification, but you know, before, up until about the 18th century, if you were going to war, you got your armies ready, you gave them the equipment they needed, you got as many cannonballs and shots and as much gunpowder as you needed, and you sent them off. They obviously needed food on the way, and they would plunder the local surroundings, but they basically had the equipment they needed for the war. That was no longer true by the middle of the 19th century. War had become incredibly costly in terms of equipment, in terms of what was used. Guns were getting more and more sophisticated, firing faster and faster, and so war was now something where you not only had to get your armies equipped, but you had to keep them equipped. And so the home front becomes increasingly important. The home front no longer is something that you leave as you go to war and come back to when the war is over. The home front now is an integral part of the war. The connections between the home front, the connections between civilian society and those armies and navies in the field now are absolutely crucial. And so increasingly, what people begin to do is argue that we can no longer restrict war just to fighting the forces on the field or the forces at sea. What we have to now do is fight the whole society that is producing those forces, because without that support from society, the armies would not be able to continue fighting, the navies would not be able to continue at sea. And so, as I say, the old distinction between civilians and soldiers, the beginnings of an attempt to treat civilians as if they have particular rights, now begins to break down again in the face of the growing demands of modern war. Not yet total war, but total war is going to be what happens in the 20th century. In the Franco-Prussian War, again, I think you see a very interesting and then horrific forerunner of what is going to happen. The Germans defeat, or the German Confederation defeats the French armies quite quickly. The final great battle is at Sedan in the autumn of 1870. But French resistance goes on, and the old traditions of the revolution come out. A government, or succession of governments, calls on the French to rise up. And there is, in some parts of France, very, very strong opposition to the German occupation. Even in Alsace-Lorraine, which is has always been a back and forth between France and the German-speaking parts of Europe, German soldiers were attacked, there was sabotage, German occupation notices were torn down, and when the German forces marched French prisoners by, the crowds spontaneously sang the Marseillaise. As much as they could, they showed their resistance. What also happened throughout France, and a lot of France was occupied by the end of 1870 by German forces, is groups of armed civilians, citizens, began to organize themselves. They were called the Franc-tireurs. They sometimes had guns, hunting guns. A number of French farmers would have had guns in their households. And they began to take shots at the Germans. And the German military forces were both puzzled and outraged by this. They felt that such war was illegitimate. And the Franc-tireurs and those who expressed their opposition to the German occupation, in fact, were treated as having no rights at all. They were seen as conducting illegal acts. More than that, they were seen as conducting treacherous acts. And the German occupying forces used a policy of savage reprisals to attack those villages, those areas where there had been Franc-tireurs activity. Von Moltke, the German chief of the German general staff, said to his generals, the most effective way of dealing with this situation is to destroy the premises concerned, or where participation has been more general, the entire village. And when that didn't work, he said, we just need to hang as many as we possibly can as an example to the others. He had in his headquarters an American general from the Union forces in the American Civil War who told the Germans, who listened, I think, with a certain amount of interest about the various campaigns in the American Civil War where civilian premises had been destroyed. And so I think you begin to get a sharing of information, not just among civilians, but also among those who are beginning to carry out the new sorts of war. The Franco-Prussian War left a deep impact on the German army, which from that point on, certainly up until the end of the First World War, regarded armed opposition, armed resistance in territories which it had occupied as completely illegitimate, and which argued in successive international conventions and conferences for the loosest possible definition of occupation, not necessarily firm control over a piece of land, but simply the presence of some German soldiers there. There were attempts, even as this was happening, to try and rein it back. And so there were going to be a number of conferences held between 1871 and 1914, which attempted to impose some sort of order on this tension between occupation, invasion, and resistance. There was a Brussels conference in 1874, where very acute divisions between the Germans on the one side and most of the other participants on the other side emerged over the issue of what actually counted as an occupation, what actually counted as resistance, and what was legitimate reprisals. There were debates, stultifying debates, over what counted as organized irregular forces. If a group of people got together, could you consider them as somehow a legitimate force? And the Germans argued that they would have to wear very visible badges, they'd have to carry their arms up openly, they'd have to have some sort of discipline. France and smaller nations said, no, people sometimes just rise up spontaneously, you can't expect them all to find a nice badge and wear the same color uniforms. And these were arguments that were going to go on. In the Hague Conference in 1899, where the major powers met, there was a convention agreed on the law and customs of war on land. It outlawed collective penalties against civilian population, but not entirely. It left open the notion of illegitimate acts of war. And who decided what was an illegitimate act of war was also left open. And in practice, what it meant was the occupying forces who decided what was a legitimate form of resistance and what wasn't. In 1907, a second Hague Convention drew up a second set of conventions about the laws of war. And again, the old divisions between what counted as legitimate occupation and what counted as legitimate resistance again came up. And again, the Germans tended to be on the side of saying that most civilian resistance is illegitimate and we will retreat. We have every right as an occupying force to treat that resistance very, very severely. Well, then of course came the test of the two world wars where such ideas were put into practice. In the First World War, there was, of course, a large amount of occupied territory. Belgium, but also Serbia, large parts of the borderlands between Austria, Hungary, and Russia, suffered occupations, in the case of Belgium, for the duration of the war, in some cases in the East, for less time. And it was quite clear that there was no agreement on what was considered legitimate and what wasn't. One of the things that we used to think was that all the stories of Belgian atrocities, all the stories we used to hear about the ways in which German forces behaved in Belgium, were the act of British propaganda. And I think we now know, thanks to research of historians, that a lot of those acts did in fact take place, much embellished, of course, by British propaganda, but the Germans did go beyond what most people, the German forces, did go beyond what most people would have felt were legitimate ways to keep resistance under control or to deal with resistance. And so, for example, the German military would round up and shoot at random a certain number of people in an area where there had been acts of resistance, or they would burn buildings in an area where there had been, as they saw it, acts of resistance. They also took large numbers of Belgians off to work in Germany in forced labor, and this was something which all previous conventions on occupation had outlawed. Well, it was in the Second World War, and I'll skip rather rapidly over the 20s and 30s, but it was, I think, in the Second World War that the question of resistance and the importance of resistance really comes to the fore. A far greater area was occupied in the Second World War than had been occupied in the First World War. Some 180 million Europeans spent most of the war under one form of occupation or another. Initially, with the suddenness of the series of German and Italian victories, resistance was relatively limited. Civilian population seemed to have been absolutely stunned, as many were, of course. In fact, I think often the German military themselves were stunned by the speed of the German conquests. Gradually, they began to realize that there might be some hope, that there might be an end to the occupation, but it took the passage of time. I mean, the initial reaction was one of just a shock and a sort of acquiescence. Gradually, however, as the war went on, some hope began to reemerge. And of course, it was very important here that there should be information. You couldn't rely on occupation newspapers. You couldn't rely on the sorts of information being put out by collaborative governments or by the Germans themselves. But gradually, people in Europe began to find other sources of information. Independent radio was important. Swedish radio, Sweden remained independent, was important, but especially, of course, the BBC, which became, for people all over occupied Europe, a source of unbiased information and eventually a source of hope. Gradually, clandestine presses began to spread up in the occupied territories of Europe. In Belgium, for example, by the middle of the war, there were some 12,000 people engaged in producing and distributing clandestine newspapers, and there were some 300 underground newspapers, which formed a very useful function in simply reminding Belgians that there was an alternative, that there was perhaps some hope. In a curious way, the absence of hope in certain parts of Europe also contributed to resistance. And awakening hope was clearly going to be an important factor, but in other parts of Europe, it was the absence of hope that created resistance. And what I mean by this is the Germans, in particular, but the Italians also, behaved in such ways that people realized they were likely to get killed or destroyed, or their families destroyed, whether or not they resisted. And when you are driven into that sense of despair, then resistance seems at least a way out. Hitler gave orders, of course, to treat, particularly in the east, the occupied territories with the utmost brutality. He ordered his generals and he ordered the SS to annihilate all resistance. He ordered indiscriminate reprisals and collective punishment, which had the effect of turning people even more against the Germans. As one German diplomat in Greece complained after a massacre in a village, he said, "The wonderful result of this heroic deed is that babies are dead, but the partisans continue to live." Leaving people with very little choice meant that the choice they might take would be resistance. Randall Hansen, an historian who has written a very interesting book on resistance, German resistance to Hitler, put it very well, I think. He said, in the German Nazi order of things, civilians would not be killed in order to win a war. Rather, the war would be waged and won so that the murder of civilians could be perfected. And so hope or the absence of hope, and I think they played out in rather different ways, could both lead to resistance. Resistance, of course, took various forms, and it was not all armed resistance, and some of it may not seem to us very heroic, but I think even small acts of resistance were important. The range of resistance could go from very sullen silence. There were movie theaters in which Germans all over Europe, there would be newsreels showing German victories, and the audiences would remain absolutely silent. If the German newsreels, or the newsreels made by the collaborationist governments, showed British forces, and the audiences would burst into cheers, until that practice was banned, of course, by the Germans. There was non-cooperation. There were attacks on those who did cooperate with the Germans, and women in particular who fraternized with Germans were singled out for particular disapprobation among their peers. Except, this is, I think, in the case of France, at the end of the war, a number of women were tried for fraternizing with the Germans. Prostitutes, however, were treated much more lightly because it was argued they were only doing their jobs. Jokes were also a way, I think, of resisting. When Rudolf Hess fled to Scotland, all over Europe, the graffiti appeared saying, "Heil Hess." Rudeness was a way of showing dislike for the occupation. If a German came into a theater or a movie theater or a restaurant and sat next to someone, say in Belgium or Denmark, it's quite uncommon for people to get up and simply move away. A German officer in Warsaw complained, and one cannot feel too sympathetic for him, that even the Polish schoolchildren were rude to him. They laughed at him in the streets. There were also sometimes quite spontaneous gatherings where people came out to celebrate national holidays. In Denmark, there was a huge series of singing festivals across the country, which they drove the authorities crazy because they couldn't tell people not to sing. But when everyone came out into the countryside, into the villages, into the towns, and sang en masse Danish folk songs, or even the Danish national anthem, clearly there was something more to that. People used symbols. The Czechs stayed away from the streets on the anniversary of the Munich Agreement. Peoples all over Europe planted their flower beds in the national colors. Now these are small, I think, but important things. I think it helped to keep people, and in people a sense that they could somehow, at some level, resist what had happened to them. But of course, there was a much more active type of resistance. All over Europe, you began to get networks for helping Allied airmen and soldiers escape. You got networks who helped to find military intelligence. Some of it very useful indeed. Before D-Day, for example, French intelligence gathering, a gathering of intelligence by French, by the French resistance, helped the Allied forces to get a very good idea of, for example, the strength of the blockhouses that had been built along the French coast, helped them to get an idea of where the gun placements were, helped them to get an idea of how many German forces there were. In a number of European countries, almost as soon as the war had started and almost as soon as the countries had been defeated, people began to prepare an underground resistance, and they began to prepare their forces for what they knew would be a long-term strategy. These were not unrealistic preparations. In Poland, for example, within a month of the fall of Poland, the Polish National Army, the Polish Home Army, was set up, and a Polish national government was set up. But the Poles knew that it was going to be a very long struggle. What they wanted to do was create an organization which would be ready when the German occupation began to falter. As one Polish resistor said, it's when the Germans have had one leg shot away that we might be able to move, that we can prepare ourselves for that day. We know that it is going to take a long time. In Poland as well, because I think the Poles felt they had so little choice, and their treatment was, of course, particularly brutal by the Nazis, who regarded them as subhuman and therefore not worthy of consideration, the Poles did not just set up an underground army and an underground government. They actually built a whole alternative set of institutions, from education to judicial institutions. And in France, after the initial shock of defeat, which left a collaborationist Vichy government ruling over a good proportion of France, gradually you began to get people joining the resistance. How important was the resistance? And this is a debate that goes on and I think will always go on. It depended. There were places where the resistance, armed resistance, was very important indeed. On the Eastern Front, for example, Soviet partisans who took, particularly on the borderlands between the Soviet Union and the German-occupied territories in the center of Europe, partisans who went into the forests and went into the swamps were actually very effective. They could tie up German supply lines, and as those lines got longer and longer, it meant the Germans had to leave more and more troops to protect them. They carried out acts of attack, they carried out acts of reprisal on the Germans. The toll that the German army took in return on the civilians was dreadful. It's been estimated that in Belarus, 78 civilians died for every one German soldier killed. So terrible proportions. But what it did do, I think, is to help undermine the German invasion and occupation of the Soviet Union. And so the Soviet, I think, partisans were important. In France, it is more difficult to estimate because so many of the activities that the resistance carried out were carried out against German targets, but seemed to have made little difference. Another great problem with the resistance, of course, is that so often the resistors were divided among themselves. In Yugoslavia, for example, the Chetniks and the communists probably spent as much time fighting each other and maneuvering for position after the war ended as they actually felt fighting the Germans. In Greece, it was very much the same. The deep division between Greek communists and royalists was one that was very much there during the Second World War, and of course was going to come out in the Greek Civil War at the end of the war. On the eastern frontiers, fighting between Ukrainians and Poles, again, helped to limit the resistance that could be shown against the German invasion. As victory approached, of course, the divisions among resistance movements in some cases became acuter, because as hope emerged that Europe would one day be able to build a different sort of set of institutions and a different sort of society, people began to position themselves for a new world to come. In Italy, for example, after Mussolini fell in 1943, the resistors included everything from communist to Catholic brigades with a great many different types of political outlook inside. The war was variously for socialism, for a democratic Italy, or simply to get the Germans out. And in addition to the organized act of resistance, there was also, again, as hope began to emerge, spontaneous actions. In Naples, in 1944, as the Germans were retreating north and trying to take a lot of young men with them to act as labor, women went into the main square in Naples and tried to prevent the buses on which these and the trucks on which these men were being loaded leaving. And when the Germans retaliated, the whole city basically went up in spontaneous uprising, and there was fighting, and Naples was a good place to do this because there were very narrow streets, so there was fighting all through Naples. By the time the Allies arrived, the Germans had left, and the people of Naples were essentially in charge of their own city. So it is difficult, I think, to know just how effective the resistance was, given its divisions, given the maneuvering in different countries, between the different types of resistance. It was important, I think, partly because it helped to give people a sense that they had actually defeated the occupation. I think it was also important because it gave at least some myth around which people could build a society for the future. You can see this, for example, in France. When de Gaulle arrived with the invading Allied forces after D-Day, he insisted, against the preferences of Eisenhower and Mountbatten and Montgomery, that Paris should be liberated. It was not a necessary military target. They could have bypassed it easily and just kept pursuing the Germans. But for de Gaulle, it was absolutely crucial that France be liberated. And in the summer of 1944, as Paris was liberated, de Gaulle made a speech from the balcony at the Hotel de Ville, and he said to Paris, liberated by itself, liberated by its people, with the support and the help of the whole of France. And that became a founding myth of the French Republic after the Second World War. It was almost impossible for 20 to 30 years to examine the history of France during the Second World War. It was impossible to examine the history of all those who collaborated, impossible to examine the history of Vichy and the enthusiasm with which Vichy went to meet some of the Nazi targets for example, deporting the Jews and the Jewish the French Jews and also those Jews who had come as refugees. It was impossible because the myth of the resistance was something that was seen by French ruling elites, particularly, of course, those on the right, as something that was necessary for France to try and overcome its national trauma. When Marcel Ophul made the Sorrow and the Pity, the Chagrin and la Pitié, which did explore, it made in 1969, he explored collaboration and resistance. He had numerous interviews with people who'd been there. He had very important material on the persecution of the Jews by the Vichy regime. It was not shown on French television until 1981 because it was felt it was too disruptive to this sense that the French had, this fragile sense that the French had built of themselves. When the director of French television went to see de Gaulle, who by this point had retired, and said, you know, this film should be shown on television, it's so important. It does show important and disagreeable truths. And de Gaulle apparently replied, France does not need truth, she needs hope. And so the resistance is always, I think, going to be something we talk about, we debate about. When is it justified? Does it actually do anything very much? How important is it, and how should we remember it? My own view is that it is important that there should be acts of resistance, that there should be people and groups who say, no, this is too much. They may not make much importance in their own time. Adam von Trott was part of a failed plot, which did not dislodge Hitler in 1944. But the fact that he committed that act of resistance, I think, is extremely important. And the fact that there were always individuals who in their own ways committed such acts of resistance, I think is something we should remember. And I just want to end with a German professor of Romance languages who was there in Dresden in 1933 when the Nazis took over. He was a Jew, but completely secular, had never felt himself to be a Jew. And he looked at this takeover with gloom. He said, it's all going to be awful. He also complained, as he did always, about his health. He said, I probably won't last much longer. I'm not going to make it. And he said, all I can do is bear witness. And some of you may have read his work. It's a man called von Klemperer, Victor von Klemperer, who kept a diary throughout the period, from 1933 to 1945, was spared from being sent east to the camps because he was married to an Aryan. And grumbling the whole time, complaining about his health the whole time, he did, in fact, bear witness. And I think those are the sorts of individual acts, as well as the collective ones, that we need to remember. We should not judge them entirely by their effectiveness at the time. We should judge them by their effectiveness for the future and for the rest of us. Thank you.